My guest in the second hour is certainly a legend, introduced, I think, to the music world through the duo Peter and Gordon. Very, very popular in the early 60s, mid-60s. Peter Gordon had a special relationship with Paul McCartney, and from that relationship he observed a lot about the Beatles, all of them. He's written a book entitled The Beatles from A to Z, which is alphabetically, sort of, kind of. He explains that in our interview in the second part. You're going to learn a lot from Peter about not only Peter and Gordon and the Beatles, but Peter has produced hit after hit for such great stars as James Taylor, Linda Ronstadt, Cher, Steve Martin. He produced his banjo records of recent years. Just so much information from Peter. Wonderful person. Had the great opportunity to meet with him and chat. You're going to hear a lot of Beatle music. Get ready for it. Second hour, Peter Asher. Wonderful guest, wonderful discussion with him about an incredible life in the field of music.
Hi, this is Peter Asher. I'm a big bluegrass fan myself, and you are here with me listening to Unreal Bluegrass.
We just listened to World Without Love, which is a perfect introduction to my very special guest for Unreal Bluegrass today, Peter Asher. How are you, Peter?
I'm very good, thank you.
Thanks so much for taking time. I know you're on tour right now. And
Yeah, we're here in a hotel lobby, and I have to go to soundcheck in about an hour.
But well, we'll get there. We'll make it.
But no, I enjoy the road, and I'm happy to do this.
You, several reasons I wanted to chat with you today. I appreciate all your time. But the very first one was that I think of Peter and Gordon. But I also, now I immediately found this book, which is an amazing book.
Thank you.
An Alphabetical Mystery Tour of the Beatles from A to Z by you, and it's written on Henry Holt and Company, I think, published it.
That's right.
But this book springs from a radio show, I think, or some ideas that you had from a radio show.
Yeah, I for the last 2 years, I guess, it must be 2 years because we're on our 140th show, I've done this radio show on the Beatles channel, Sirius XM, where I just talk about their music and about them and play stuff and generally ramble. And I did, in my quest for trying to think of what to do to make up a new show every week, I did a series of shows based on the alphabet, not trying to be encyclopedic or completist in any way, but more using the alphabet the way Sesame Street did, you know, to just pick a letter and sort of see where it leads you. So I would use a letter of the alphabet for not just song titles, but people and places and things and concepts and time signatures and musical terms or whatever. And actually, the book was not my idea, I have to confess. Henry Holt came to me. They were sort of pursuing me a bit, and I thought they were probably trying to get me to write an autobiography, which is what I've been pursued about by a few publishers and have declined. But they said, no, we know you don't want to do that, but we think that the Beatles made as their radio shows could be turned individually into the chapters of a book, and it might be quite fun to read. And I went, oh, well, that sounds kind of easy. You know, I'll do that.
How long did it take you to put this together?
Much longer than I was going to say. Because, you know, of course, when you just transcribe what you said on the radio, it's horrible. And in addition to that, of course, on the radio, you talk about the song, and then you play it. In this case, you talk about it, and then talk about it some more.
Then you talk about it some more.
And you have to explain it and why it's good and get into some kind of actual musicological aspects of it. And so I like doing that, but it did take about a year, I guess, to do all that and to finally deliver a book. And I worked with a very good editor, Henry Holt. But the writing is certainly all me, and it did take a while.
The great thing you do about it is, first of all, everybody should know that you have a special relationship with Paul McCartney that goes way back.
Yes.
On a personal level.
Yes.
And so you take that and you develop your own personal life stories into things that Paul did or the Beatles did. You also dig deeper into things that they did at a level that I'm so happy, by the way, that you actually exposed Ringo Starr as a very, very talented percussionist. I feel like he always kind of got the short shrift because he was surrounded by geniuses, and you make sure that Ringo gets all the credit he deserves.
I do. I think he's a terrific drummer, he's somebody who like writes drum parts that are exceptionally cool and then plays them very well. So he never plays the obvious part. You know, he listens to the song first. And I love drummers who do that. So, yes, I'm a big Ringo fan.
And some of the fills, we'll get into some of the chapters just for instance sake. But you talk about stuff that he's doing when you say he writes drum pieces. He's in the moment. He's listening to the song. But he's not playing the words, but he's playing something very specific that probably no other drummer of his time period would have played. They would have gone into a natural rhythm and a beat until the next. But he's still totally different.
And not just the fills, but just the regular part. You know, when he... it starts about a song. It very rarely goes straight to the regular drum part.
Yeah.
It'll be some peculiar, you know, counter rhythm thing that, that makes the song, you know, there's a great help to the song. So yeah, that's why I think of him as an arranger as well as a player.
That's good. And I'll ask you this question a little bit later, but your relationship with Paul McCartney. I don't want to give away things in the book, but I think everybody knows that the song that we heard at the opening of the show, "World Without Love," that Paul wrote that,
yes,
and
yes,
it was a special relationship you had with him that allowed that to happen. But I'd like to talk just a little bit about that early time,
mm-hmm,
when you were performing as not Peter and Gordon, but
Gordon and Peter. Oddly enough, yes, it was the record company that turned our name around. We naturally made Gordon first because he was the lead singer. He sang the melody. He was the tall, handsome one. You know, it seemed logical. And it was actually the marketing people at EMI Records who said, no, we think Peter and Gordon sounds better. We're changing the name. And who was I?
Who were you to argue? Yeah, that's fine.
So Gordon took it very well. And so we became Peter and Gordon.
And you for a while, a couple of years, Paul lived...
Yeah, but the so-called special relationship. I mean, we were neighbors, you know, roommates, whatever.
Right.
We shared the top floor of my parents' house in London because he'd been hanging around a lot anyway. He was going out with my sister, and that meant he was in our house a lot. And eventually, our parents offered him the guest room, and he accepted it. I mean, he was working too, as
right.
was I. So
right. Well.
But we got to know each other pretty well during that time, and that's how I heard that song.
Well, and he had written part of it, the way the story goes, and as you're being converted from Gordon and Peter to Peter and Gordon, you need one more song.
We needed a hit. I mean, we hadn't recorded anything yet, but as we were preparing for our very first session, the Norman Newell, the A&R guy who signed us, had picked some songs from our live show. We were working a lot in clubs and pubs and coffee bars. And
you must have been getting some attention. You must have been getting noticed because did they come to you and say, hey, we've got some time in a studio?
No. I mean, there was word of mouth. Yes. People were coming to see us.
Right.
But no, Norman was somebody I think was there not specifically to hear us, as far as I know. He was somebody who went to this club, the Pickwick Club, and heard us and liked us and signed us up. And he actually had some songs in mind for us to do from our live show. He was thinking of us very much in the folk mold. You know, the sort of Kingston Trio, Peter, Paul, and Mary. You know, we were going to be Britain's answer to the folk boom, I suppose.
Well, and as an aside, now, let me get back to that, the development of the sound in your studio time. Peter and Gordon, actually, you were sort of in that point where there was, in America, they laughed and called it the Great Folk Scare. But in England, folk music was making its way over there.
Oh, yes.
And you were very much in the... And skiffle, which you mentioned twice in the book,
yeah,
was a form of music that Americans don't have any idea what
was going on. No, skiffle was such a big deal. I mean, there's a very good book by Billy Bragg about skiffle and the skiffle craze. And he estimates, based on serious research, that there were 50,000 skiffle groups in England at the same time. I mean, because everyone had one, because it was so easy. You didn't have a drummer, you had a washboard. Your bass was a tea chest, or, you know.
I think Jimmy Page even had a high school skiffle group.
Everyone did. And the Beatles did, as we know, you know, the Quarrymen.
Yeah,
so
that's right. Go ahead.
I had a skiffle group. Everyone I knew had a skiffle group. You'd learn three chords and a couple of American songs. You'd do Midnight Special and, you know, Don't You Rock Me, Daddy-O, or whatever. And you were a band.
So I didn't mean to take you away from you were talking about getting into the studio and needing some more songs. You were doing some cover songs.
Well, it wasn't so much, actually, when you think about it, it wasn't so much that we needed songs. But Norman had picked some songs, and I think with What Would Our Life Hadn't Come Our Way, our first single in his mind was going to be our version of 500 Miles, the old folk song, because he loved the way we did it and thought it could be a hit. Maybe it would have been. Who knows? But he also did say, if you know of some other good songs that you want to bring to the session, feel free to do so. And that's when I remembered this song of Paul's, an unfinished and rejected song that I'd heard and liked.
Well, it was unfinished and it was rejected by a bandmate of his.
John didn't like it.
Didn't like the way it was going.
John thought the opening line was ridiculous. Please lock me away. He thought that was a foolish way to start a song. And maybe he thought it was too wimpy for the Beatles, too. I don't know, which made it perfect for Peter and Gordon. We were wimpier than the Beatles.
You were wimpier than the Beatles. Your sound is so great. And I've spent a lot of time listening again to things that I had and finding new music that I didn't have from Peter and Gordon. You have a bigger catalog than I remember.
Yeah.
You put out a lot. You did some covers. You did High Noon, which is totally different than what anyone would have thought from
the
movie.
Well, that was, you see, that came out on, and the Americans made a point of always messing all your albums up. You know, they did the same to the Beatles.
Yes,
they
right.
mixed everything up.
Right.
We made an album of film songs. In America, they decided, instead of putting that out,
bust them up.
Sprinkle them liberally, which was kind of weird. So suddenly, well, what the hell is High Noon doing here?
But it's
I'm
very,
not crazy about that album, but they were fun to sing.
But it's a very, here's the point I'm making, is at the time that folk and rock are still sort of looking each other over, you're doing songs with a lot of orchestration. There are horns.
Yes.
There are string sections.
Yes.
There's really acoustic kind of folk stuff, and you're also doing early rock. You've covered a lot of different
things. Yeah, we love. I mean, people forget that Brian Jones, you know, from the Stones, played on several of Peter Norton records, and you know, we were less. I think it's often the case that the public divides things into genres a lot more than musicians themselves do. You know, and we were very happy playing with Brian Jones or some great R&B musicians, and you know, as we were. Singing folk songs and stuff, so we loved it all of it being American music, of course. But so we had fun. I mean, we did, and I loved. Or even then, I loved good songwriters. You know, we did a couple of Phil Oakes tunes when nobody was covering Phil Oakes.
Yeah.
We did a version of Flower Lady, which was I put on the B side of one of our big hit records, because Phil was a friend and wanted to help out. Phil remained a friend until the end.
In your use of the alphabet, which I will tell you, you mentioned it right, that it's more like a Sesame Street approach.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you in the chapter on H, you discuss A Hard Day's Night, but you say you always thought of it as an H song. And
because you think Play A Hard Day's Night.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. So it doesn't always follow true to form.
Oh, no, it's exactly. Now, some people have said, you know, it's a bit muddled the way.
No.
It is, but in an amiably.
You're navigating through. You're putting in your personal knowledge of what you knew about them. You put in knowledge into this book of very intricate chord changes that the Beatles.
I talked about some of those things. Yeah, because, you know, I'm not a brilliant musician by any means, but which is why I think maybe, you know, I did a whole chapter on time signatures. Not a whole chapter, but
when
I
go.
And
I think it was under T.
That's it was, and that's when I was worried that I, you know, on the radio, that I would lose people. And I kept saying, "I hope this is okay," you know. And I got more positive emails on that show than any other. They were going, "That was so interesting, and you had me counting all the time. I understand now the difference, you know, what adding in a 2/4 bar means and stuff." And my music teacher at school never explained it this well, and it was very flattering. And people enjoyed that and learned from it, you know. And I said, look, if something's in 5/4 time, or, you know, and you try to dance to it, you'll suddenly realize something isn't
working. Sometimes I'm not doing it right.
Right.
As Frank Zappa says, the song goes on and I'm still wrong. In each of these chapters, I could go through, and I don't want to give away things in the book, but for example, in the chapter on K, which there might not have been a lot of songs in K.
Yeah, I can't remember.
But I'll tell you this, what you do, the name I had only heard and maybe seen on graphics credits for the Beatles, I first heard his name when George did the Bangladesh concert and he introduced us Klaus Voormann.
Oh, right. That's right. I put Klaus in the K. Yeah.
So you flesh out Klaus Voormann, who has always been this person that most Beatles fans were aware of, but you really put him in where he belongs as a musician and what he did.
And a musician, and as an artist.
An artist.
I mean, let's not forget, the same guy played bass on most of John Lennon's great records and also designed the cover for Revolver,
which is a rare achievement. Rare achievement and a fantastic album.
Yeah.
I think Rubber Soul and Revolver, to me, at that time period, there was course, everything they did was, but Rubber Soul and Revolver, to me, this is my opinion, which is worth nothing, I just thought those were fabulous albums.
Yes.
Sonically and lyrically.
No, it's true, they are.
You even talk about Norwegian Wood in here.
I do.
In a different chapter, doesn't start with N.
I can't remember where does that
come from.
I don't know.
but you do, you might have been when you were talking about, you start talking about pipes.
Oh, I do talk about wood a lot.
Yes, you did.
Because I talked about xylophones and marimbas and also the different woods they make guitars out of and how they sounded.
That's right. Yeah. And so you were able to bring in all those things, which I just thought. I honestly was smiling the whole time I was reading this.
Thank you.
And I had the internet handy so I could say, wait a minute, what's he talking about
right,
here? And I could check it out, which is what I think people should do, or just read the book and go back and do searches on it. But in the chapter on G, for example, you're doing G songs.
Yeah.
But it gives you the opportunity to tell everyone that you were in Germany with the Beatles as Peter and Gordon.
That's right. I used to use for German and Germany, because, of course, they recorded some songs
in German. Right.
They also played a lot in Germany.
Right.
Which, of course, I was not present for any of that. I met the Beatles first when they came down from Liverpool.
Right.
One of the ironies is that at the time, when we first came to America, you know, everyone assumed that everybody was from Liverpool, because they just heard, oh, the Beatles are from this great place. And they were going, what's Liverpool?
We thought the whole continent was called Liverpool.
I know. And that it was great. Because people would go, what's Liverpool like? And I go, one, I've virtually never been there. We've done like one gig there for a night. You know? And secondly, it's kind of awful. It's a funky port town. And everyone I know from Liverpool, the minute they could afford a train ticket,
they get out.
They were in London.
That's right. I want to take a break here while we're chatting. I'm not finished with you yet, but we've talked about some of the early music of Peter and Gordon.
Yep.
We've talked a little bit about the skiffle influence, which I'm telling you, people in America can't appreciate how important
Lonnie
that
Donegan.
Was.
Remember Lonnie Donegan.
Yes, I've.
Now, everyone who's seen the Judy Garland movie,
have you seen it?
There's Lonnie Donegan.
That's right.
And I'm sure 99 out of 100 people who see the movie have no idea that he was a real person and a huge star.
He was a huge star. There's a lot of English people that are huge stars that we barely know about. I'm going to get into that when we talk about the letter U. But I want to cut to Lady Godiva now, because not only does it fit well into what we're talking about in the kind of the sounds of Peter and Gordon, there's a banjo in it.
Yes, there is.
So I'm going to take just a second. I'm talking to Peter Asher. I'm going to play Lady Godiva. We'll be back in just a second.
Okay.
All right. That was Lady Godiva, as I mentioned to the audience. One of my favorite Peter and Gordon. Maybe because, Peter, we didn't get a lot of the stuff that wasn't over AM radio back in the early 60s in America.
Right.
Lady Godiva was one of those.
Yes.
And it's still a wonderful song and brings up wonderful images. But that I think, is pretty stark. The banjo and the guitar and the singing, a little bit extra to it.
It's got horns and stuff on it.
But yes.
I can't remember what kind of banjo. I didn't play it. A studio musician played it. And I don't think it was a five-string. It was probably a four-string banjo, because it's more a bing, 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 bing.
Right,
bing,
right.
But it's not, because I play, I've never, I mean, I did learn the banjo for a while. I tried. I had a five-string banjo. I got the Pete Seeger book and everything. I can play slightly, but I'd love to be able to play it properly. I have so many friends, you know, but when your friends, you know, complain, like Steve Martin and Billy Connolly, let alone Tony Trischka and Bela Fleck, you don't pick up the banjo.
It's a little hard. It's a little hard to follow them.
Point. Exactly.
Although they would all be very gracious as you learn.
They would. But I need a lot of lessons from all
that's
of them.
Right. That's right. The as the book progresses, and it doesn't bounce around, but I love the style, because maybe that's the way my brain works. But the letter U I mentioned to you before we cut into Lady Godiva. There's a place for ukuleles in England that does not exist in this country.
Right.
Ukuleles we think of as the flapper times and maybe some Hawaiian stuff. But ukuleles, and I'm talking about this because George was very involved in ukuleles.
Yes, he was a big George Formby fan.
I was going to say George Formby. You mentioned it for me.
Yeah, my father was a huge George Formby fan, and so was I. When I'm Cleaning Windows.
That's exactly right.
Fantastic song. And he was a great player. He was a big movie star in England, too. He made several musical movies. And you can find YouTube clips of George Formby, and I recommend them highly. He played the ukulele and the banjo-lele, the banjo-ukulele, about half and half, I think. But he played brilliantly. There's a whole... I found a whole website devoted to analyzing the George Formby strum, because he does this kind of triplety thing, you know, when he's playing a regular rhythm. And, you know, he's doing things with both finger and thumb that are very hard to figure. He's breathtakingly good.
He is. I have friends from England. Mm-hmm. One of them I went to high school with, a friend of mine today. When I go to his house, they're all British. He grew up here, but he was born there. Mm-hmm. It takes nothing for them to get into a George Formby song.
And so I thought
I got to find out who this person is. And again, in this country, ukuleles are not. But in George, I'll bring it back around to George.
Yes,
loved ukuleles.
Yes, he did.
Really, really loved them. And
well, you know, there's that great moment in the concert for George where Paul played "While My Guitar Gently Weeps" something.
Yeah,
he played something on the ukulele.
Yes,
and it was killer.
That's an example of how you use the letter U. And you pull in ukulele.
Yeah, pipes as well.
That's right, you do. You also, in one of the chapters, I think it's the I chapter, because you had a bookstore. Indicia.
Indica,
okay.
Yep.
Indica. And you bring that in the I section, and in that book, we all know this happened. But yeah. you it was kind of an avant-garde bookstore. You had yes. some artsy feels to it, and you would go in when you were in town. You would go yes. kind of be there.
Yep.
And you read about a very
well,
avant-garde.
John Dunbar was my partner who ran
yeah.
the art gallery.
Okay.
In separate premises.
Thank the
art
you.
Gallery
Thank
the
you.
So, and so it was in the art gallery. John had heard about this Japanese-American artist.
Yes.
Yoko.
So you bring Yoko Ono in.
We did.
And who sees her there for the first time?
Exactly. That John went to the little pre-opening do we had. And that's when he and Yoko met.
And I've heard the story where he climbs the ladder. And
yeah.
He says
yeah.
the mic, the glass, and he looks at the word yes.
Yes.
I never connected it to a bookstore. Certainly never connected it to you. I just always yeah. heard that that's something he did at an art show.
Yes, it was our art gallery. Yeah.
The this book is full of things like
that. A lot
of
these things are in the show that you'll see later.
Oh, okay, sure. Sure, well, that's fine. Well, nobody's going to hear this before
no,
the show.
No, but I'm just saying, you may find it interesting.
I think it's fascinating. I'm talking to Peter Asher, and I've become absolutely committed. I don't know how many of these I've sold, but everyone I see, I say, go buy an Alphabetical Mystery Tour. The Beatles from A to Z, which you have to point out in there that, yes, it's the British use of the Z,
yes.
so the Americans aren't confused.
Yes, actually, and I succeeded not only in having it called A to Z, but the spelling of the book is all English. I said to Henry Holt, you've got to switch over your spell check mechanism or whatever you guys do, because it's going to be in English. And they went, oh, okay.
There's so many
so
great...
a lot of extra U's.
You and Peter, I look down at the book and I see James Taylor's name, which reminds me, I could spend 10 minutes... telling the listeners about all of the incredible music that you've produced and been involved in. Linda Ronstadt, James Taylor, Cher, Steve Martin, we were talking about
yes.
earlier.
Yeah.
And Neil Diamond. You had Neil. You've been involved in so much production of great music.
Yeah.
And I know I know, which is just like the soundtrack of so much of me growing up. I heard all those things.
Yeah.
When the Linda Ronstadt special shows. And I forget the name of it. It's my voice, my life.
Sound of My Voice.
Sound of My Voice. You figure prominently in that, and you wind up on the screen quite a bit talking about Linda and how you met her and what she was capable of.
Yes.
Which, by all accounts, if we knew that, we probably knew it. We didn't know it to this extent. She was pretty much capable of anything vocally.
Yeah. Yes. She was. She is, but she doesn't sing anymore. The finest singer it's ever been. My pleasure to work with. She's quite extraordinary.
Well, let me ask you this: in the book, then you talk about. I don't know how to describe what producers do, except maybe you lend an ear or maybe you add a technical. I don't know, but you mentioned the fact that you kind of modeled yourself after Brian Epstein.
Oh, as a manager.
As a manager. As a manager. Yes. Yeah, as a manager. And it's more, it wasn't that you tried to do what he did, but the faith in your artist and all
yes,
the passion.
Yes, I mean, what Brian made clear to me is that, a determination and a belief in the artist are obviously the primary ingredients. And I think you have to be, reasonably intelligent and clever and determined. But one thing was clear to me, Brian was the guy walking around London saying he had a band who were going to be bigger than Elvis. And, everyone laughed at him. And, of course, he was right. And he treated them, with a protective kind of air that was exactly right. And that's what they missed so much when he was gone. Yeah.
Manager, let's talk about what you do as a producer, because I'm not sure that people really realize what you do.
Well, it varies on case to case, case by case, of course. You're responsible for everything overall, but it's certainly a joint effort with the artist. You're working in conjunction with the artist, and that's the key moment is when you talk in front about how we're going to do this and how can I help you get to where you want to go and how are you hearing it. I mean, in some cases, it includes choosing the song in the first place. In some cases, it doesn't. In some cases, it involves hiring musicians. In some cases, it's a band, and then you're not. So the exact definition of what a producer does varies case by case very much.
Now, I'll make this personal about me for a second, only to get to the next point. When I first became aware of your name, not the one word Peter and Gordon, when I first became Peter Asher, I should have known this before, it's when Steve Martin had released Love Has Come For You with Andy Burkell.
Interesting.
So the first time Steve was a guest on Unreal Bluegrass,
yes.
I had taken notes about everything that Edie, every reference that Edie wrote, these incredible lyrics,
yes.
these pulls from all these sources, one of which winds up being the inspiration for the Bright Star, which is the railroad thing.
Yes.
And so Steve calls me in the morning, we're still going to do this, yes, what do you want to talk about, this, okay, that's fine. I said, you have to tell me Peter Asher. He said, I'd be happy to. So when I got him on the phone, And you wanted to know about Peter Asher, and I thought, what an idiot. Of course that's who it is. And
right.
for some reason, I was so intent on getting everything from Steve and Edie, and I read the liner notes,
right.
but so he went on and on about what a wonderful friend and what a wonderful artist that you are.
Right.
And how apparently you just produced a new single coming out from him and the Steep Canyon Rangers.
Yeah.
California.
Yes.
Which happens to be released the day as we're sitting here.
Brilliant. Great. Yeah, no, it's really cool. It's a great, another great song Steve wrote. Yeah.
So their first effort with Edie Brickell is Love Has Come For You.
Yeah.
And then in between that and So Familiar, which you also dealt with, a theme, and I remember asking Steve about this. It sounds to me like you're working on a story, and he said, "Yes, they're putting these things together to branch off into this Bright Star project, which was a Broadway play, which you were also involved in."
Yes, I was the music supervisor on that, and I produced the cast album.
Heard the cast album, didn't get to see the show, but just great tying in of all those themes and use of the music.
Yeah, it was good. It was a good show, and Carmen, our leading lady, was miraculously good. It was an excellent show. It wasn't a hit, you know, but at least we made it to Broadway and ran for 100 performances.
You made it to Broadway.
Yep.
You were nominated for one of those editors.
Tony.
Yeah, yep. Tony, yep. And that.
We were.
That's not so bad for
your
first one.
No, not at all. Though actually, it was not my first Broadway show.
Okay.
That's funny because Steve wanted me to produce the cast album, and the production company for the show initially were kind of going, well, there's people who really know how to do that, you know, because it has to be done very quickly and everyone's on, there's a very union situation there. It's all like how long you have people and,
So
he said, no, I've done it before. And they went, you have? And I went, yes. And it was about 20 years earlier, I guess, at least, when I did the Linda Ronstadt in Pirates of Penzance.
Yes.
And it was the same situation then, because Linda had said, Peter has to produce the album. And Joe Papp was going, I don't know, you know. And she's going, trust me, he knows what he's doing, he'll figure it out. And that's the first time I produced the cast album for a Broadway show, was Pirates of Penzance with Linda Ronstadt. And then we did the movie version of Pirates of Penzance. I produced that too.
I remember that.
So I got to produce Angela Lansbury and people like that. It was fantastic.
And Linda then goes on, were you involved in her Spanish?
Yep.
Okay.
I did those.
Which again, if you see the special about her, which you discussed and you're there, just gives you an example of the range and the thoughts that she had. She wanted to do Gilbert and Sullivan because she grew up hearing it.
Yes.
She wanted to do the Spanish Mexican because that was part of her heritage.
Yes, exactly. That was a great album to do. And, you know, Linda just sang so brilliant. That's the biggest selling Spanish language album
I heard that. Wow. Even with all the different music coming, you know, bleeding back and forth, to be there, that's incredible. Incredible. You're on tour right now, and you're doing music, and you're also talking about some of these bits from this Beatles.
Some bits will show up.
Yeah.
You'll see. It's a mixture of everything.
It's a multimedia.
It is the multimedia thing. There's a lot of little video clips and photos and stuff.
Let me talk then just a little bit more about Peter and Gordon, because I can't stress enough how much, not only have I enjoyed reading this book, but because I wanted to get back into that time frame. Do you remember how many albums you released as Peter and Gordon?
No, I don't. I mean, I think we had about 9 hit singles. I'm not getting muddled about the albums. I'm not sure.
And like you say, they transform. Now
they move
around.
Yeah.
Something else I wanted to mention, I mentioned James Taylor, and he's on the front of the book writing a recommendation. I did not know that when Apple was formed, you were right there with Apple.
Yes, I helped start Apple. I was the head of A&R for the label.
And then one of the very first people you pulled in was James Taylor.
Yeah, he was actually the first person he signed. When I met him, unrelated to Apple, I just met him through a friend.
You also said something in the book about the Apple label versus how it was really handled in America. There's even a mention in there where Apple stickers were put on things.
Well, what I meant by that...
Explain that for me.
I was simply saying, people said, well, weren't the Beatles on Apple?
Yes.
And the answer was not really.
Not yet.
I mean, Capitol Records were distributing Apple Records. Apple Records was a genuinely independent label that signed artists.
Okay.
In order to give Apple substance, it was agreed that the owners and the bosses of Apple should appear to be on Apple. But, I mean, so they were. Their records had Apple labels on them. They were on Apple.
Right.
But, of course, in the actual business arrangements, in no way did EMI and Capitol give the Beatles their contract back. They were really still signed to EMI.
Yes.
EMI were releasing them as Apple Records.
As Apple Records. That's what I... Yeah. Thank you. That explains that.
Yeah.
The very last thing is the Zed chapter.
Yes.
Which I think was kind of clever.
I don't know how many songs you can pull up that have the Z in them, but you do an interesting thing.
Well,
about
it turns out there are two Beatles Z songs, and I've completely forgotten one of them. Now I can't remember what it's called. I remember the one called Zigzag, which is a George Harrison song, but there's something else Z-ish that I forgot, that everyone is reminding me. Said, why didn't you put in whatever it's called, this Paul McCartney song that's Z? Just forgot it. But so what I did was invent the Beatles Zoo, which gave me access to everything.
That's right.
You know, it gave me access to a whole lot of animals, because I talked about in the zoo, the Beatles Zoo would theoretically be every animal that is featured in a Beatles song.
Right.
And it's an extraordinary list. You wouldn't expect. Everyone knows about the walrus, but there's a lot.
All the dogs. Paul wrote about his dogs.
A lot of dogs. Martha is his own sheepdog, is featured, of course. Yeah. And a bulldog.
That's right.
A horse with a name. Henry. And so on and so on.
And you also, go ahead.
But anyway, and also it was he gave me the zebra crossing to Abbey Road Studios.
Which to the world is an iconic, must have been the one and only, but in your description of the zebra crossings, that's kind of everywhere.
I mean, there's lots of zebra crossings. Yeah. But that particular one, yes. I mean, taxis avoid that route because there are always people on that
standing
crossing.
In it.
You have to, everyone's having their picture taken. So it's, and you know, the law is, if there's pedestrians on, they have to stop. So it's a slow crossing.
I imagine everybody takes their time walking across once they get there.
They take their time walking across because they want to make sure that their friends got the picture. So it really is certain peak times, it's a bottleneck. And then also the street signs keep getting stolen. The actual metal street signs that say Abbey Road are now like bolted on, and they still get stolen.
They'll still steal them. Where there's a will,
they
there's
a way.
If they make it there and they're standing there and there's nobody around, they're going to find
the
way.
In the middle of the night.
You do a wonderful job in the book of following individual careers in order to fill out the alphabet. And we've talked about Paul, your relationship with Paul. John, you've gotten into his individual separate career. Mm. We've talked about how much I was so thrilled to see Ringo being featured and his ability with and without the Beatles.
Yeah.
And then you really do a nice job of focusing on George Harrison, who for so long, you know, the joke was he was allowed one or two songs per album.
The Quiet Beatle, yes.
The Quiet Beatle.
Exactly.
He was my favorite because he was always, I know they all played guitar, but George always played the guitar.
And he was the serious lead guitar player.
He was a great
player.
Played
a lot of different styles.
He was,
and again, he was not just a player, but an arranger. In other words, he'd never just start doing some flashy directionless solo.
Yeah.
It was always something he'd figured out at that part of the song.
Do you a couple of reissues from George Martin's son, Giles. Have you had a chance to listen to those?
Oh, yeah. I love them. No, I usually go, and they have like a playback thing when they put them out. The most recent one was the Abbey Road, which I went to in London, because Paul and Ringo came to that, so they invited me to come, which I did.
Let me ask you a question. You've probably been asked this before. All of four of them together, did they create something that surpassed the parts? Were they something together that they built on that they, even though they may have had their distinct geniuses, didn't the four of them together, did they create something unique?
Yes, without doubt. I mean, yes, they're all brilliant, and they all would have become stars, I believe, whatever. But their meeting was a kind of a perfect storm, you know, because musically they fit together incredibly well. And personality-wise, I mean, in the same way, you know, when they devised the Spice Girls, it was like Posh Spice, Sporty Spice, whatever else it was. You know, it was as effective as that, but it
accidentally.
You know, it was like the quiet one, the kind of one with an edge, you know, the one all the mums and kids loved, which
that's
is
right.
funny,
oh,
Ringo,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
And Paul, the super charming, handsome one.
That's
so,
right.
So you know, if you devised it. As a put together boy band, you couldn't have done it. It was miraculous.
There was tension. I'm talking to Peter Asher. I'm going to let him go in a minute because I know he's got a show tonight. There was the tension between them that I think helped. You know, whereas John didn't like World Without Love, somebody else didn't like something else, and they so there was always this tension.
Yes, which I think resolved itself. They figured out how to work around all that stuff all the time. It really was only when those business issues came into play and the whole Alan Klein fight and everything that things really got. You know, where they weren't speaking to each other. Because every band goes through a big change, because at the beginning of a band's life, you're living together. You know, you're very often physically and literally living together. The Stones were, the Beatles were. And it's only when you're on the road you're certainly living together. So you stop going on the road and you all get rich. And you've all got houses and wives.
Right.
Suddenly you're not living together. It's
right.
different. You know? And it always involves a major change in the relationship.
Wonderful book. This is so much fun.
Oh, thank you. No, it's great.
I can't wait to hear you. I'm sure there's things that not in the book that you have that you carry with you and come to you as you're maybe performing.
Yeah, there are some. Yes. Yes.
So that'll be wonderful.
Yeah, and the show is a little bit different every night.
Sure.
Stuff occurs to me.
You told me earlier that you're like in a little more than halfway through 12 shows on this tour.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I go back to L.A. because it's Grammy week, and I'm part of the Recording Academy, so there's a lot of stuff going on there.
I can't wait to see you do
this. I'm going to be in New York. I'm having dinner with Steve in a couple of days, so looking forward to that.
I never go through someone that I know to get to somebody else, and I went to Steve to get to you.
Yeah.
And I could have found you. You're right. I just wasn't showing up on any hits, and I finally wrote to him. And
no, not to worry. He was great.
Five minutes later,
he recommended you, and he said, and he wants to go to you.
5 minutes after I write to Steve, I get an email from you, and I'm talking to you, and I appreciate that. I hate to bother him to do that. I just feel like he's awfully kind.
No, he was fine. No,
he's awfully kind.
He spoke highly of you, And I said, of course I'll do it. I'd love to.
And I met him through a banjo player, which I tell people. They say, how can I reach Steve? I said,
do you play yourself?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Uh-huh. So I met him through a mutual friend as a banjo player. Contacted him, and I eventually met him. But it was a banjo player named Mark Horowitz, mm-hmm. who lives in New York, who mm-hmm. was Bela Fleck's original teacher. He's been playing forever. He's played with everybody. And he says to me, hey, I got this new thing from Steve Martin. He sent it to me, and he says, would you want to talk to him on the show? I said, sure. I don't know him, but I'd be happy to talk to him. I'll figure something out. Lunchtime later that day, I get a call from this guy. He says he'll do it Saturday at 3 o'clock, and that's how it started.
Great.
And I spent a lot of time. We were going to take 20 minutes, and Steve kept saying, no, let's go further. It was like an hour, first time I ever talked to him, so we talked about all this interesting.
Well, Steve is serious about everything.
Yes.
He's serious about his music, serious about his... I mean, when you think about it, he is one of the most remarkable people we know, because, you know, he's a playwright, he's a comedian, he's a magician. He's
an author, magician.
He's everything. Yeah. And all very good.
Yes.
He's
a curator for art.
Absolutely. And my wife's an art collector as well, so she's bonded in that world.
Well,
they're both buying this Aboriginal stuff that he's looking at.
I hated to make it personal to me because it's about you, but I wanted to let you know why I did that.
And I
rarely do that, and
totally
it worked
fine.
Out fine.
No, it's great. I mean, I get lots of emails from Steve, and that was a good one to receive.
I appreciate your time. Peter Asher, I'm going to let you go as we're leaving. I think I'm going to play Boy with Nothing, an early Peter and Gordon song.
Absolutely.
Probably in the same show, I'll play the song from Steve Canyon Rangers that came out today, which you produced, the California song.
Thank you.
Fix that all in the same thing.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good record.
And then we'll move on from there. Thanks so much, Peter Asher. I can't wait for the show tonight.
No, anytime. I'll come back whenever you need me. This has been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll let you go.
All right. Thank you.